Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch up on the political news of last week and get you all ready for the week ahead. Joining me at the not-so-round table is Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daryl Worland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC6.
Good to be with you again, Anna.
And Jesse Balmert, state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Hello, Jesse.
Hello. Happy Monday.
Let's get into it. So you know that we're probably going to vote on raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour in November. Well, a Republican senator has come up with a plan to do it first. Bill Blessing wants to raise our minimum wage for hourly employees to 15, not tipped workers, though. And he wants to give all families at the bottom of the pay scale a tax refund. It might not go anywhere, but the plan, the very idea of Republicans doing these things, has left Democrats, well, surprised. To quote Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio, holy guacamole, Jesse.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I was kind of running down what was in this bill to the Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio, and particularly the refundable earned income tax credit was a shocker to her, partially because these are concepts and ideas the Democrats have been pushing for quite some time and really have not gone anywhere in the GOP-controlled legislature, which is one reason why this group is working on a ballot measure to put it on the November ballot. They have to collect over 400,000 signatures by July in order to make that happen, but they feel good that they're on that direction. And so we get the situation that we have seen before where when there's pressure from the citizen measures, the legislature proposes something.
And Megan, yeah, because the legislature passed medical marijuana when it looked like we were going to get a medical marijuana ballot amendment. But you know what's fascinating to me? They didn't do this with abortion and they didn't do it with recreational marijuana. Do you think it's possible that they're learning from their mistakes, so to speak?
It seems like it. I mean, the lawmaker directly said that this is because of this proposal that we are putting this forward. And there are some interesting differences with it. Tip workers would not receive the same minimum wage that non-tip workers would make. But yes, I think they're learning from previous elections.
Yeah, this would the ballot amendment, Daryl, would essentially eliminate the tipping wage, make it all one minimum wage. States like Oregon and others do this now. So what is like the Ohio Chamber of Commerce saying about all of this, or the Ohio Restaurants Association?
Gee, do you have to even ask? I don't think there's been a minimum wage increase that I've seen either group support, and especially the restaurant workers. I mean, you're talking about a really substantial jump.
Almost a doubling if the amendment, the raise the wage campaign passes.
Yes. And, you know, and the argument is, and I'm not saying it's valid or invalid, the argument is that this is at a minimum going to make your food cost more because you have to pay the workers more. The tip workers are typically in, you know, service industries like that. Most typically your server at a restaurant.
But you might tip less. Like in Oregon, they tip about 10-ish%.
Well, it could be. But then the apocalyptic scenario is, well, more restaurants will close because they can't afford to stay in business.
And, you know, the fight for 15 feels like the kind of thing that Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown would be happy to champion this November. Do any of you think that this might also be about heading off that advantage for him in November?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's another just piece of this puzzle, another way to just make this November election even more divisive, so to speak, and it's another layer thrown into it with having both of these potentially on the ballot, of course, with the Senate race and then with the proposed ballot amendment as well.
So, Jesse, so this is being pushed by Senator Bill Blessing, and it would have to get through the Republican-controlled Senate. And Republicans traditionally aren't super into the idea of making large jumps in the minimum wage. So does he think it's possible?
Well, I think Senator Bill Blessing is a guy who really tackles big issues in the legislature, and so this is one of them. And I also think that people know that this is popular. It polls very well. I think Republicans would acknowledge that if it gets on the ballot, it's very likely to pass. That's certainly a fear and concern of the Ohio Restaurant Association. And so If there's a way to head that off, that's certainly something they're going to pursue. I know this bill is getting committee hearings this week, but it is also an issue where Republicans have traditionally not been a fan of raising the minimum wage. They traditionally have not been a fan of this refundable earned income tax credit, which the way that kind of works is for lower income individuals, when you get this credit, if it is more than what you owe in taxes, right now, Ohio law is you don't get any money back. So this would allow you to get some money back, which would be important because a number of people in the lower income bracket don't have to pay very much or maybe anything in income tax right now. So it would certainly increase the amount of this tax credit. Senator Blessing thinks that this is just better policy. So we shall see. But, it's a combination of ideas.
This could be the lesser of two evils for the Republicans in their eyes, so to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, look, even if Blessing gets this bill or some version of it out of the Senate, I would also have to get through the Ohio House, which is my segue into talking about Speaker Jason Stevens. He appears to have reached his boiling point with the faction of his caucus that is actively trying to take his job away. He stripped six Republicans of their leadership positions last week. What happened here?
Well, this has really been building for quite some time, and it's a little bit in response to the primary. There are four different Republican incumbents who lost their seats, and there are Republican House members who donated money to their opponents. So you're seeing a lot of things that used to be very passé, like you used to not campaign against fellow Republican incumbents. You used to not have outside money in primaries. You used to not strip people of their committee chairs. So it is really just more symptoms of this ongoing infighting over the past speaker's fight and then leading into the next speaker's fight.
Daryl, it's a bit of a Republican civil war over there.
Oh, no question. And I'm guessing this battle has come up on almost every weekly show you've had for, the past several weeks, if not months.
Always simmering in the background.
Okay. Yeah, well, but it is, is controlling what gets done over there, or we should say what does not get done. Everyone's gearing up for the speaker fight next year, the anticipated speaker fight. And again, for those who are just cluing in on this, Jason Stevens is the current speaker of the Ohio House. And the only reason he is speaker, because he has Democratic support. Republicans don't like that. Over in the Senate side, Matt Huffman is the Senate president. He must leave the Senate due to term limits. He's coming over to the House, presuming he wins election in a safe district. And he wants to walk right in and go from Senate president to Speaker of the House. So almost every aspect of the debate of anything that the House touches is framed in that reference as this. Well, what's Huffman feel? What does Stevens feel? And these sides are, relatively speaking, evenly matched. We're not sure how it's going to come out. People hedge their bets. Bottom line is, not a whole lot gets done. So, to move back to substantive policy, as this minimum wage proposal would be, it's sort of a question, one, can Bill Blessing, is he regarded as enough of a mainstream Republican in the Senate, and that proposal enough of a, if you will, the lesser of two evils, as Megan says, to get it through? And then, even if it does, what happens in the House, which is getting almost nothing done? And, that's... We just stripped away several committee chairpersons. And not only that, took them clear off the committee. So this...
Yeah, it wasn't just a demotion.
Yeah, this it is was like shades an outright, of something we haven't seen in quite some time.
And it's not just like you lose a position in leadership. If you are a committee chair, you make an extra $9,000 a year. So we're about halfway through the year. Logic would say they're maybe looking at least a $4,500 pay cut because they've lost their chairmanships. And I want to play a clip of Jason Stevens, the speaker who stripped them of these chairmanships, when he was talking to reporters.
There was a lot of Republicans in our caucus spending money against other Republicans in the caucus, which is exactly the thing that they accused me of going to do, and they turned out to be the ones who were the ones who actually did it.
And then Phil Plummer, he's one of the representatives who lost his committee chairmanship, and, well, he's not thrilled.
And his excuse is what we did with political donations. Number one, it's election interference. Number two is he's a dictator that won't let conservative members do their jobs.
Representative Plummer also says he's considering filing an ethics violation against Stevens. What is the case he's trying to make here?
You know, I've not heard about the ethics violation, so I'm not 100% sure. Do you guys know?
I'm not up to speed with that either.
Okay,
You scooped us, Anna.
Yes.
I guess he's saying that, like, you know, retribution for political donations is an ethics violation. But we'll see.
Lots of luck making that argument. I mean,
yeah.
You know, he's repeatedly also courts have found that political contributions are free speech protected by the First Amendment. And Jason Stevens just said, well, yeah, they're spending money to defeat the Republicans. Well, guess what? He did the same thing with official caucus money, is my understanding. So, yeah, we have tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars being spent in Republican primaries by Republicans, and Democrats have just got to be, you know,
I mean, they're just
loving it,
eating their popcorn, sitting back, watching it go down.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, okay.
Yeah, and it's a situation where if the Republicans were united, if they were all rowing in the same direction, then the Democrats really would have very little say in the Ohio House of Representatives. So these divisions really benefit Democrats. The other thing I would say is there is this fight over the campaign money, which could play out in Franklin County Court. And there was a vote that a number of Republicans took a week or so ago to take that money away from Stevens. And then obviously Stevens, as the speaker, feels like he's still entitled to control it. So that is, I mean, whoever has that money will have a significant advantage.
You know what I find fascinating? So Representative Scott Lipps chaired the House Public Health Committee, and he lost his position, too. But what I found fascinating was he said he was told by a lobbyist. That's how he heard about it. He didn't hear about it from Jason Stevens himself.
Wow, what a slap in the face. I think, too, like we were saying earlier, this has been simmering in the background for quite some time. But now this just brings the drama front and center, and everyone's talking about it. It's very apparent now what is going on. And, too, we're seeing bills pass in the Senate but not be brought to the House floor. I think of Senate Bill 83, the higher ed bill that would overhaul higher education. And then I think of marijuana legislation as well, that this is not agreement on the Senate and the House side.
Yeah.
You mentioned Scott Lipps, too. He was the chairman of the House Health.
He's been the chairman of the Health Committee for a while.
Right. And he's been a leading proponent. You know, it's a cause near and dear to my heart, and, you know, could reference the Dispatch days, reporting about our friends, the pharmacy benefit managers, the obscure but very powerful middlemen in your drug supply chain, determining your prices. He was very active in trying to crack down those at the state level, because the feds have just bollocks this altogether. So the regulation across the country is mainly coming from state governments. So you are taking a very key player out of that whole debate. You know, this is just one of 100 examples, I'm sure. But trying to reform PBMs to rein them in, PBMs are also celebrating.
You know, Jesse, they're doing some things, though, because the open seat left by Bob Young, who was arrested and convicted on charges alleging that he was convicted on the domestic violence charge? I want to be careful how I phrase that.
I know he was convicted, but I don't know if it was all. I know it was not of all of the original charges.
Yeah. So, anyhoodle, he was arrested allegedly for an altercation involving his wife and I believe his brother. Ultimately, he resigns, and now we have a new Republican office, Jack Daniels.
Yeah, great ballot name.
I know.
I must say, I spoke with new Representative Jack Daniels and at an event earlier, and he had come to the state house multiple times in order to be sworn in, and so this is kind of, he's finally in the seat, but there, that even shows a little bit of the behind the scenes back and forth about getting him seated.
Wait, so he made the trip, he drove down from Northeast Ohio, because this is a Northeast Ohio street, so he drove down like an hour each way multiple times.
That is what he said.
Okay. Woo. I'm going to leave that there. Coming up, the latest on student protests and how it's become a political talking point for Republicans at all levels. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, and still with us is Jesse Balmert, state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC 6, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Ohio State's graduation was on Sunday, and it went without interruption from pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli demonstrations, but it definitely didn't go as planned. One person died after falling from the stands during commencement. So, you know, not the protest we thought might have happened, but certainly not the way Ohio State wanted this graduation to go, Megan.
Yeah, definitely. It's still unclear as of this morning from what I've seen as any details about the person who died, if they were a student or not, their age, their gender. But yeah, definitely not the celebration that people wanted. It sounded from what I was reading that the news kind of spread throughout the stadium as the hours-long commencement went on. But yeah, definitely just not the day with the pomp and circumstance that you'd want.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. My heart goes out to their family. I'm sure we'll know more about who it was. I mean, you don't want it to be anybody, but for it to be a student on their graduation day just feels particularly awful. But, you know, they had graduation, and it looks like Columbia University is going to cancel its graduation ceremony scheduled for next Wednesday. USC in California has already canceled its commencement. And I think what stings about this situation for me is these are the high school graduates of 2020, right? So they're essentially missing out on both major graduation ceremonies in their lives. So it's
the COVID kids and now the protest kids, if you will.
But, you know, Ohio politicians of all stripes and sizes have weighed in on these protests at Ohio State and nationally. Let's start with you, Megan. What have you heard from Senator Jerry Serino?
I haven't actually spoken to him directly about this, but I heard from Speaker Stevens last week that he supported the actions that Ohio State President Ted Carter has put forward in response to the arrests the other week, where about 40 people were arrested due to protests. And so he said that he supported basically following the rules, that these protests were disruptive and that the rules need to be enforced. We're not trying to silence. He basically was like, we're not trying to silence anyone, but people's safety is what it comes down to. So that is what I heard from Speaker Stevens.
Daryl, what about Senator Sherrod Brown and his opponent, Republican Bernie Moreno?
Well, Sherrod Brown initially told a Washington outlet it was something that was kind of ambiguous. And of course, this being the political world in a re-election year, for the senator. The Republicans immediately hopped on it and said, see, he supports Hamas. And
it's a real tightrope for Brown, right? Because his base may have more people, more younger people who are more sympathetic to what's happening in Gaza.
Right. And the very next day, he had his weekly reporter call-in, and he clarified that, you know, certainly supports the First Amendment, people, right of students and folks to protest this. Don't get violent. Don't violate the rules. Don't be destructive. Was sort of his message. Which seems like a pretty mainstream message. I mean, it's kind of the same thing that Mike DeWine is saying, and a lot of the establishment folks. So we'll see how that flies.
Republican Senator J.D. Vance was also on CNN talking about the protests, and he said that students have a right to peacefully protest, but when things get violent, they should be prosecuted. But then it took a turn, let's say, that interview, because CNN's Caitlin Collins essentially asks, well, isn't that exactly what happened with January 6th? And shouldn't those people who stormed the U.S. Capitol have the full weight of the Justice Department thrown at him? And it was really interesting to see him thread that particular needle.
Yeah, that was an interesting clip to watch. He basically argued that was a very different situation. I believe he said it was a double standard. So, yeah, he definitely tried to thread the needle, but the CNN commentator was trying to point out some similarities between these protests and also the January 6th riots in terms of the disruption.
Also, former President Donald Trump hosted a bunch of potential running mates at Mar-a-Lago over the weekend, and one of them was our own Senator Vance. So, is it finally happening this time, Jesse? Because Rob Portman and Sherrod Brown have both been floated as VP shortlist candidates before.
Ohio is a popular place to put on your shortlist of candidates, it appears. Yeah, Vance was at Mar-a-Lago. Turns out, my invitation was lost in the mail, so I'm not entirely sure how that all shook out this weekend. But he's certainly one of the final contenders for this among Tim Scott, Kristi Noem, a variety of other individuals.
Elise Stefanik from New York. Yeah.
Correct. So what would be interesting is if he were selected, we'd be in a spot where Governor DeWine would have to replace an appointment, and then we'd have a whole nother election for a U.S. Senate, which would be
in 2025.
Yet another, yeah.
Because, yeah, that's how Ohio works. It's kind of weird and wonky, right? The governor would pick someone ASAP, and then the next scheduled November election, we'd have a Senate race.
Right. Well, and before that, we'd have yet another Senate primary, presumably.
Whew.
I mean, who's not looking forward to that in Ohio? The Washington Post did quote, I guess they talked to a source and had audio of the Mar-a-Lago meeting, and they quoted Trump as saying, JD has turned out to be incredible. He wasn't a supporter of mine. It shows you I can change him.
And he's also really good friends.
Wow, what an endorsement. I can change you, so maybe you'll be great on the ticket. And just think of what, I'm sorry, Anna. But,
oh, go ahead.
And again, say he gets picked, say Trump wins, so he's vice president. I mean, let's look down the road to 2028. Who's got to be one of the, Lord knows what could happen in his 4 years.
As much as we talk about Biden's age, Trump is 77 years old. It is entirely possible that the VP is more important for both candidates given their age.
Yeah, and we thought, back in the 2000s, Barack Obama zoomed upward from kind of nowhere to the state legislature.
No, this is the same trajectory,
whatever.
Yeah.
This is even faster. J.D. Vance never had office before. He, in fact, was a critic of the guy who may appoint him. He was a businessman. Then he won the Senate seat, put in there basically by Trump's endorsement. Yeah.
People would be like, well, what does he deliver, right? Because Ohio is a pretty solidly Trump state. It's very likely that the former president will win the state of Ohio come November. But J.D. Vance has a lot of ties to conservatives in venture capital, like Peter Thiel, who bankrolled his campaign. So maybe Trump is looking at this pick in particular, in my opinion, as accessing more of that conservative venture capital.
Well, it's going to depend. Peter Thiel, my understanding, went to donating to super PACs and things like that and sort of cut off his donations to all or at least most of individual candidates because Vance's Peter Thiel money came early, which is very important in that Senate campaign because he didn't start out to be the favorite by any stretch. But then he didn't get any for the general election, as I recall.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it goes. The Republican National Convention is in Milwaukee in July, so we'll know by then. Although I think Trump has said he's going to take a couple more weeks to make his choice.
And Trump is coming to Ohio later this month he's slated to headline an event in Cincinnati that J.D. Vance is a guest speaker at.
So maybe you'll get your invitation, Jesse, and you can be there if they announce a ticket together.
Mm-hmm. Cincinnati is also very nice.
It is.
So, go Bengals.
Last week, Secretary of State Frank LaRose announced he'll be cleaning up Ohio's voter rolls ahead of the November 2024 election. Now, this is something he does every year, and as usual, he's getting a bit of flack for it. Daryl, what's going on?
The P word comes out, purge.
Yes.
So, secretaries of state are required to clean up the voter rolls. We don't want dead voters still on the active voter rolls.
People have moved out of state.
People moved out of state. Yeah, you're not eligible to vote in the Buckeye State anymore. And okay, so we have pretty much universal agreement, I would hope, on those issues. And then it goes down to, okay, we're purging you, before and now because you have not voted enough. You have been inactive.
So it's a use it or lose it.
Yes, and that is very controversial. And part of the reason it's very controversial is not just because of the issue per se, but look, folks, the game here is Democrats want more people to vote. Republicans generally do not, because Republican voters are more loyal. But if Democrats can increase their numbers, they'll stand a chance. That's a hugely oversimplified overview. But in general, that's why you see these battles become so bitter, because everything's viewed through the partisan lens.
Yeah. Secretary, local boards of election have until about mid-May to send their lists, and then notices are supposed to go out in the mail starting at the end of the month. So if you get a little card that's like, hey, you haven't voted in 6 or 7 years, we'd like to know if you're still alive. It's very important that you respond if you want to stay on the voter rolls, right?
Yeah, and you can also go online. There's ways to look up if you're an active voter, or, you know, you can see whether you voted over the last several years. So if you, when in doubt, I'd say, you know, double check, because it is important that you're registered in order to vote in Ohio.
And it's a big election year.
Yes. Let's move on to former House Speaker Larry Householder. He's back in the news because he's going to be arraigned next Monday on new state felony charges. Jesse, what are the charges, and do we know how he plans to plead?
Yeah, my assumption is he will plead not guilty. That's a pretty standard step in the first parts of any legal proceeding. And so the charges are, to back up, the federal charges were that he orchestrated this pay-to-play scheme, taking money from Akron-based First Energy and a variety of other places to help him win back control, pass this bailout bill for nuclear plants, and then defend that law against a ballot initiative to block it. So that was kind of the overarching scheme that got him 20 years in prison in federal court. But Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost filed some charges against him in Cuyahoga County, and that was related to paying for the attorneys in that federal case, and then also some, like, ethics form disclosures, either not disclosing something that he should have or, you know, kind of vice versa. So comparatively smaller charges, but certainly never fun to be criminally charged.
And they would keep him from ever running for re-election in the state of Ohio, even if the federal charges were overturned.
Yeah, that's where it's significant. One of these charges would, you know, create a ban on him running for office again. Now, is that something he's likely to do? It's hard to say, but he has had one prominent comeback already.
And Daryl, the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, which is the watchdog for, you know, all of our energy companies here in the state, is looking for auditors to go through the books of several coal plant invested electric companies. They're checking to see if hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies that the companies collected were justified. I mean, it feels like, I don't know, what's going on there?
Well, I saw that. I wonder, where did this come from all of a sudden? Because we should, when you say watchdog, we should inform listeners that we're all making air quotes when we say that, because the Public Utilities Commission has been, evidence will show, has been anything but a watchdog on House Bill 6 or utility issues in general. I think there's widespread agreement on that. So all of a sudden, it's like, you know, what we're talking about here, House Bill 6, the big glut of money was to keep the nuclear plants alive, the two that are up along Lake Erie. But there's also a little bit for these coal plants.
And that's the part that's still on the books.
I'm sorry?
The subsidy for the coal plants is still on the books.
And that's the big difference. And that is not, you know, First Energy had, and then there's ensuing spinoffs, control the nuclear power plants. It's a coalition of electric companies, of utility companies, including the majority or the largest stakeholder is American Electric Power, who sort of skated by this whole thing without discussion. They own interest in these coal-burning power plants. And we always have to add, including one on the Ohio River, yes, but well into the state of Indiana.
Yeah.
So, you know, Democrats have wanted to get to the bottom of this. You know, how can you justify this? So for them, if they actually do this, this is a well worthwhile study. I think most Ohioans would agree, because it's like repeatedly Republicans have refused to take that part of the subsidy off the books. They've not paid for it politically yet, but, you know, let's find out. What's this costing ratepayers?
And, Jesse, we can't talk about the House Bill 6 scandal without talking about dark money. And you had a very interesting article about what other states have done and why Ohio maybe is lagging behind.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting because Arizona in particular a couple years ago voted, like their voters decided to require disclosure of dark money and other kind of like independent expenditure spending. And I thought that was interesting because they kind of took it to the ballot, whereas in Ohio, there have been efforts, I mean, going back decades to even when John Husted was speaker, to try to disclose more of this money. And they just have not passed the Ohio legislature. And there's a variety of reasons for that. In part, both Republicans and Democrats benefit from this system and companies benefit from this system. But just the money that we are learning about in the House Bill 6 scandal is only because of the FBI and the Federal Department of Justice revealing this information, some intrepid reporters kind of digging back into past records and a number of lawsuits. This is not information that's easy for people to access.
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating parts of House Bill 6, and there was many fascinating parts of the bill and its scandal, is the actual court case is when we finally saw where all the money went. So the $60-ish million that Larry Householder is accused, or I guess convicted of at this point, of taking as a bribe, we finally saw where it came from, where it went, how it got spent, and all of that like was kind of behind a curtain before the trial.
Yeah, and it's worth noting because of this U.S. Supreme Court decision and kind of the following decisions and the way it's been interpreted, companies are allowed to give unlimited money legally. This is all legal. And so it's just a situation of, is Citizens for Puppies and Rainbows actually some company that's trying to do something else, you know? Or if someone's attacking a candidate, you know, with friends of puppies and kittens, like, you don't know how this is actually influencing politics. And, you know, I think they have certainly under this court decision a First Amendment right to make these donations. But would it be helpful for people to know where that money is coming from?
And you're right. This has been kicked around because you're not going to outlaw this with Citizens United. And as Jesse says, the ensuing U.S. Supreme Court decisions, you know, that would probably require a U.S. constitutional amendment at this point. But it's like, okay, legal donations are required to be disclosed in other settings. Why not, quote unquote, dark money? It's an idea I remember Jennifer Bruner had when she was Secretary of State, you know, way back when, which probably would have been about the same time John Husted was Speaker of the House. And again, it's just, she hit the nail on the head. Pretty much all parties involved in this process, in these transactions, benefit. So once again, to expect legislators to go against their self-interest, that's a tough lift.
And speaking of puppies and kittens, oh, this is like, I'm so happy you said that because I was like, how do I segue? So speaking of puppies and kittens, State Representative Sarah Carruthers, a Republican from Southwest Ohio, comes from the Procter & Gamble family, and she's proposing putting an end to cosmetic testing on animals. Megan, what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so this was interesting to read about. So yes, she is basically trying to ban all cosmetic testing on animals. But it sounds like it is more complicated than that. Testing in on animals in Ohio, I should say. That would be makeup and things like that. It's tested currently on rodents, dogs, and cats.
Shampoos, hairsprays, anything that is not medical, essentially.
Yes, exactly. Basically, just seeing how much can you ingest in order until it's a lethal amount. But it sounds like it's more complicated than just that. Sounds like that could be if it's not tested on animals, then having to make tissue could be a cumbersome process to try to then figure out how to test this before putting it on the market. So sounds like it's not quite as straightforward as initially it comes across.
Because you have to know whether it's toxic. It's just a question of how we find that out.
Yes, exactly.
Coming up, we're going to get into the latest news on the lawsuits about abortion and transgender teens. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's still our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on all Ohio politics. Still with us is Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC 6, and Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. So, Megan, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has sued the U.S. Department of Education over recent changes to Title IX. What's the gist of the lawsuit?
Yes, so he is one of several Republican attorney generals who have filed lawsuits recently over these changes. He is on this particular lawsuit. It was filed with Ohio, Tennessee, who is leading it, as well as Indiana, Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia are also on the lawsuit. But basically, the new title law rules that will take effect on August will offer increased protections to LGBTQ students and staff. And it's interesting that it includes transgender students, which that is basically the crux of what Attorney General Dave Yost is not a fan of. He said in a statement that Title IX was meant to protect equal opportunities for women. This new rule says there are no opportunities that are exclusively for women, and men who identify as women can use programs and facilities designed for women. And it's interesting to note that in Ohio, there are a couple of bills that are trying to prevent these things from happening. House Bill 68 would, among other things, ban transgender girls from playing on girls' sports teams. Now, this bill was set to take effect at the end of April, but a temporary restraining order issued by the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas has currently blocked the law. And then House Bill 183 would ban transgender students from using the bathroom or locker room that matches with their gender identity. This bill was recently passed out of the House Higher Ed Committee, but is yet to go to the House floor. But it is making progress in the House.
Yeah, and there's a lot of these, transgender athletes, the bathroom access. A lot of that is tangled up in Title IX and whether they have protections. And so ultimately, it sounds like they would like the U.S. Supreme Court to weigh in on what is the meaning of Title IX, whether a president can make a rule change or whether he's fundamentally altering what Title IX means.
Yes, we'll just have to see how this plays out. They have until August 1st before this takes effect, so we'll see what happens between now and then.
And Jesse, Dave Yost is also tied up in a lawsuit over the 24-hour mandatory waiting period for an abortion. He says he doesn't think that voters intended to get rid of it when they passed the abortion amendment in November.
Yeah, so this lawsuit was brought by a number of Ohio abortion clinics and their attorneys, and they would like to eliminate some of these rules, like the 24-hour waiting period, which they argue ends up being much longer than 24 hours. Some of the information that you need to provide to someone who is obtaining an abortion. Their argument is that Ohio already requires informed consent, and doctors have these codes about, you know, telling their patients what the risks of any sort of procedure or pill could be. And also that people have thought about this decision before coming to the clinic. Some of them might be coming from another state, which is becoming more and more common as the U.S. Supreme Court kind of put these decisions back on state lawmakers and so forth. So that's the gist of the lawsuit. The attorney general who's representing the state in this needs to respond to that lawsuit. And his argument was that most of the advertising about this was restoring like a pre-Roe v. Wade being overturned standard, and that that's what voters wanted, and that they didn't want to get into some of these other things like the waiting period. So that was his argument in the case.
And so what have reproductive rights advocates had to say about whether this was the intent of the November amendment?
Yeah, so Jesse Hill, who's the attorney representing the clinic, said that voters knew what they voted on, and this is something that they voted on. They wanted to eliminate restrictions and unnecessary kind of barriers in order to access abortion, and they say that this is one of them. And so that's ultimately something that the judge is going to hash out, but kind of a difference of opinion of what voters were thinking when they voted on this.
And while we're on the topic of the federal government, President Joe Biden has declared the counties impacted by those tornadoes back in March to be disaster areas, like specifically the one that hit Indian Lake and several other locales. And this is, you know, Daryl, I think that, you know, we always talk about disaster declarations and they feel like just something that people in government say, but they're actually really important for the recovery efforts in these places.
Well, sure, because there's money involved. That formal declaration by FEMA, the Biden administration, of, yeah, this was, does qualify as a disaster, opens the door to loans, grants to individuals and businesses. At Six on Your Side, one of my colleagues lives in Indian Lake. The tornado sort of went through her backyard, and, you know, she just suffered a lot of damage. So she's been, you know, the backlog, you could kind of imagine to get, you know, roof repair people or people to come in and inspect your building. There's such a backlog, and now it's a backlog of, okay, now that I know what's wrong, how am I going to afford to fix this? Because my insurance company, you know, that's just insufficient. So a lot of people are waiting for this. Now, some folks have made this political, gee, it took all this time. But this takes weeks no matter which administration is in power. I mean, look back to previous, pick your party, look back at a past president. This is how long it takes. The state has to do certain things first. That data goes to the federal government. They look, make sure to qualify, and now it's available. So I think it's a good thing as long as it, you know, the money flow doesn't get tangled up in the bureaucracy.
And speaking of President Biden, his administration also has announced plans to ease marijuana restrictions by removing it from the list of the most dangerous and highly regulated drugs. So it's now a Schedule 1, which means it's on par with things like heroin and methamphetamines. And it also means that in the eyes of the federal government, marijuana has no medicinal value. So the proposal would move it to a Schedule 3. How big of a deal is this with, you know, recreational marijuana is about to be legal? This doesn't change that here in Ohio, right?
Yeah, so it's both a massive deal and then perhaps in Ohio less obvious. This is something that advocates of medical marijuana have been really working on for many, many years, saying that there are some uses for this and it could potentially like free up just access and so forth, saying that it isn't the same as fentanyl and heroin and like kind of some of those drugs that we think among the most dangerous, and for good reason. But in Ohio, a lot of the rules are around like any scheduled controlled substance can't be used in certain locations. Like, for example, like if you're on a patio and grabbing some beers or with your dog, maybe. Probably the dog is not drinking the beers. But anyway,
yes.
You can't have like be smoking marijuana out there as well. And so because it's still a scheduled substance, whether it's 1 or 3 would not make a lot of difference in those scenarios.
And I know early on, at least, there were concerns about getting bank accounts for companies that were, you know, they're going to be distributing.
The FDIC thing is still a thing, I believe, right? Like if you, most banks, most traditional banks are FDIC insured, which means they back the money. And you can't be that if you are a quote unquote drug dealer, which is how the federal government views people who run marijuana businesses.
So And, you know, there's sort of been some workarounds developed in the industry, but I think this maybe opens the door to something cleaner. Just go, if I'm distributing marijuana legally, as is allowed in Ohio, I can just go get a bank account for my business.
I also think it makes it a lot easier for hospitals conducting research to get access to the drugs, to conduct clinical trials, because now there's federal recognition, perhaps federal grants for the very first time, whereas, you know, if the federal government says there's no medical value, like, how do they give you a grant to do a research on a drug that with no medical value? Yeah, so it's both a big deal and kind of won't change day-to-day life in here in Ohio at the same time. I want to go back and have a little blast from the past and talk about Josh Mandel, the former Ohio state treasurer who has run for Congress and failed, is back in headlines again because he was sentenced to 7 days behind bars, as was his ex-wife, Alana Mandel, after an Ashland County court magistrate found them in contempt of court for violating elements of their divorce agreement. So, what's going on with Josh Mandel? Don't all jump in at once.
Well, none of us wrote this story, I don't think. But first of all, isn't it... it was weird from the get-go that this divorce case is in Ashland County, which is where I grew up and all that. But
not where they lived.
It's a fur piece, yeah, from the Mandels. And indeed, in at least in the early stages, the judge down there refused to provide public
access.
They
sealed the record. It was a whole fight.
Yeah, sealed the records, and you know, something that probably you and I couldn't get on our divorce case. But now it's leaking out, and good grief! I saw the news. I thought this case is still active, and now they're threatening jail terms. It's like, wow. I mean, you know, it's just one of those stories you just kind of shake your head. And, you know, if Josh Mandel needed perhaps another nail in his coffin of if he wants to run again, I think this might be it.
Yeah, that was, Jesse, that was one of the big questions when he was running for U.S. Senate, was this divorce was sealed at the time that he was running for U.S. Senate back in 2020. And, I mean, he was arguably the front runner for a while in that race. And I know your colleague, Laura Bischoff, fought hard to try and get access because it was sort of like a weird, you know, why did he get to seal it versus like everybody else who gets divorced?
Yeah. I think it's worth clarifying. I think Gerald did that this is threats of jail time. I don't think they've been actually sentenced to any jail time yet, which may not happen. As far as the underlying public records case, the Cincinnati Inquirer sued over this because they don't live in Ashland County. It was pretty obvious that they went to Ashland County kind of judge shopping. There was no hearing on this. There wasn't like an opportunity. It was just sealed pretty immediately. And he was running for U.S. Senate, a very prominent position in Ohio, and just kind of the access to potential concerns regarding that, it was important at the time. And yeah, the whole situation right now, I just, you know, hope his kids are okay.
It sounds like in this particular instance, according to the Common Pleas Magistrate, the Mandels enter each other's homes without permission, refuse to pay bills related to their three children. Sounds like his ex-wife failed to take a child to soccer practice.
So it's a really ugly, messy divorce, essentially.
Yeah. And basically, to avoid jail, sounds like Josh Mandel has to provide his ex-wife regular updates on their children's 529 college account, and she would have to pay for a sports program for one of their children, minus what Josh Mandel must pay for things as well.
So basically, they just have an ugly, complicated, messy divorce, and because he was once upon a time a public figure, it's sort of playing out in the public eye.
Yeah, it's just a real shame, I imagine, for everyone involved.
Daryl, Jake Zuckerman of Cleveland.com had a story out this morning about injection wells owned by a state senator named Brian Chavez, and they have leaked fracking waste deep underground in Noble County. It resulted in a $1.3 million cleanup paid for by the state.
Jake has been doing some amazing reporting on this whole topic, and in fact won a headliner award just last week for his coverage of that, so kudos to him. Yeah, first of all, who knows there was a Senator Chavez in Ohio?
So I think he was appointed at the end of last year.
Yeah, he's pretty new to the Ohio Senate. Yeah, so yeah, even, you know, we reporters, we need our scorecards as well. Long story short, yeah, this guy runs injection wells, which is where you dump the brine and the other waste that is involved in the fracking process, drilling those underground wells to extract gas. It apparently is incontrovertible that the state authorities have found that this well began leaking. You don't want this stuff leaking. And oddly enough, it migrated miles underground and came out through another person's, not an injection well, but like a normal fracking well, wellhead someplace. So somehow they got nailed with the penalty, even though it was coming from the state lawmakers. You know, facility, and bottom line, Ohio taxpayers paid $1.3 million for the cleanup. The state senator paid zero.
Yeah, so it's definitely an ongoing story, and we'll have to see where it goes along with continuing efforts to frack underneath state parks. Some contracts have been awarded, quick update for those following, but no actual drilling has begun as of yet, so very wait and see on that as well. And that is actually going to do it for this hour of the Reporter Roundtable. I want to say thank you to Jesse Balmert from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau.
Always fun talking about puppies and kittens.
Daryl Rowland, politics and investigative reporter for ABC 6.
Oh, it's great to have the band back together again.
Actually, yeah, you're all my former colleagues. All of us. True. All of us used to work together.
Yeah, but Anna made something of herself, so what can we say?
And now we're at four different outlets. That's wild. And Megan Hengry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you.
Always happy to be here.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.